Yeah, let me start the recording. So yeah, about 2 weeks ago, Bob joined our Pharma DCSA sub-work group meeting, and Bob had provided an overview around the drug supply chain, pretty much like a last 20 years. Here's the where we started, here's what we progressed through, how GS1 played a role in that. So we highlighted a little bit more specifically around GS1 data standards than what we did in our last call on this supply chain SIG, specifically for pharma. And then we made it to the last slide, but we couldn't go through, which is about key takeaways. Now, if anybody wants some more in-depth understanding of what we covered, the actual meeting is fully recorded, the video of it, the presentation itself. So you can actually go into the meeting notes for the Pharma DCSA section of the wiki for this group. I'll actually repost that on this or today's meeting notes, just for your convenience. But without further ado, I'm going to pass it to Bob to go ahead and take it from here.
Okay, thanks. So just a little bit on who I am and what we're doing. Is I'm with the Center for Supply Chain Studies. We're a nonprofit organization that works with supply chains around some difficult areas that they may be having and complex issues. And the way we do things is that we actually build simulation models, and this is, you see a little bit of a simulation here, of the supply chain. So we're able to simulate product movement, people movement. We're also able to simulate information movement and also cash flow if needed. So if we're balancing two simulations with each other, we can tell which might be better from a cash flow position from the different stakeholders involved. And so this has helped us with as we've worked with. Thanks. As we work with the industry around the Drug Supply Chain Security Act, because we're juggling three complex issues. One is the supply chain itself and how it operates within the United States. The second one is the regulation, or not the regulation, but the law, the Drug Supply Chain Security Act. And that's complex in and of itself in that it is a law, which means that it is kind of a mixed, dog's lunch, if you will, in that a number of different entities in the supply chain and their lawyers had negotiated with Congress on different aspects. And so that all those little aspects found their way into the law. So when you go through the law, it doesn't really, if you're a developer, it makes no sense at all. No way you would develop a system based on what you see in this law. But that's how laws are. They're compromises and they're conflicting things inside of them. So we've had to create models on different interpretations of the law, and that's helped us understand how the industry might interoperate together. And then lastly, we were exploring blockchain, and so the complexities of blockchain itself. So we've got three layers of complexity: the supply chain, the law, and the technology. Somebody hit the alarm
yeah,
in the car.
I'm gonna start muting people here. Sorry about that.
That's all right. Sorry, Bob.
That's all right. No problem. I run a lot of these calls, and it's just you never know what happens. You hear cats and dogs in the background and kids.
But we hear you just fine. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to just go through. And again, all these slides are available. This is the same presentation that I made on the other group, so you can listen to the whole thing if you're interested. And I'm willing to bring up different slides to talk about aspects. But first, maybe if I just talk about DSCSA and some of the problems here. So the Drug Supply Chain Security Act requires at different points in time, so it is implemented over a 10-year period. But in 2023, the supply chain, each of the supply chain partners need to be able to, the product needs to be serialized, so each bottle in the supply chain, which they are today, they're all serialized, each one has its own identifier. But you need to be able to reach back into the supply chain and get what's called transaction information to be able to show the whole history or the whole lineage of where that item had been in the supply chain. So one of the first challenges is obviously the supply chain itself. products you see here on the left, that's the item that the law is interested in tracking, the package itself, the bottle or the vial. But of course, that's not how they're transported in the industry. They're put into cases, they're put into pallets. In this particular supply chain, those pallets are broken down very quickly. 97% of all products are broken down by three distributors, large distributors in this country, right back down to the package itself. So these distributors take in pallets of product and they push out on the right plastic totes that you've seen behind CVS and Walgreens and all that with the items in it. So the items will then go from the manufacturer to distributor, could go to a second distributor, could go to a third distributor, and then finally to what we call dispenser, which could be a hospital or a retail pharmacy. And so in order to track the item, we need to track all the logistics units they've been in. So there's this business of aggregating the item to a logistics unit, possibly that logistics unit to another one, in the case of the case, to the pallet, and then breaking that down through the supply chain. So it's not a simple matter of saying, I see this thing and I can track it all the way through the supply chain. There's a lot of iterations that occur. And like I said before, the language of the law is complex and it conflicts with each other, with itself. So you see here the letter of the law, which is very specific statutes within the law that were negotiated in there specifically for reasons by the different partners in the supply chain. And so we need to be able to adhere to these. And some of these are very difficult to adhere to. I'll give you one as an example that will give you a flavor for how it's difficult to track something, especially if you're thinking about blockchain, that where an item, there's a record for each movement in the supply chain. There's a statute in law that says if a wholesaler gets a return from a dispenser and they determine that item is saleable, in other words, it's not been damaged or altered in any way, they could resell that. The law specifically states that they do not have to expose or make that second dispenser aware that the item had moved prior to that. So if you're thinking about a blockchain where you're putting in events as they move through time, there's a challenge there. We need to obfuscate that one from the law. And then there's the sort of the spirit of the law. And we bounce back and forth between these two. I used to call this Plan A and Plan B. Plan A was how many lawyers can everybody send down to Washington to either affect the law or kill it. And Plan B are probably people like us who say, you know, give me a challenge and let me figure out how to make this work, which is very simple rules, I think. Don't allow any illegitimate product into the supply chain. Identify and remove the bad actors. And then start recalls where it counts, which is today recalls chase products through the supply chain. They go from a manufacturer to a wholesaler to another wholesaler to a dispenser. During that period of time of transition, a dispenser may be dispensing what essentially is recalled product to a patient. So can we use this network to get to the end of the supply chain quickly? So that's just a flavor for how complex trying to apply the statutes of a law into a system that needs to be interoperable. So now I'll explain one of the big issues that we're wrestling with. So what you see here is manufacturer wholesaler one, wholesaler two, dispenser one. Transaction information moves between the trading partners as you see here. And obviously there are established relationships between manufacturer one and wholesaler one and wholesaler two, dispenser one to dispenser two. And those are established relationships. They've created their EDI connections or what have you, and they trade information. The law requires that upon a request from the FDA or State Board of Pharmacy or the DEA or other regulatory body, that any one of these supply chain partners need to be able to produce those previous transaction informations. So I'm going to pick on the dispenser here on the right. Essentially, it means that they need to be able to go back out to the manufacturer and request the transaction information that occurred between them. And also maybe then secondarily to the first wholesaler and so on until they make all this collection. I'm just trying to find maybe a better way of putting this. Yeah, so these are the normal transactions that we're aware of and we've set up. And then these are so essentially what's happening almost on the fly, we're creating new relationships between trading partners. So you see relationship number 5 in the bottom, which is the dispenser and the manufacturer. So this is a case where the dispenser is trying to verify the product with the manufacturer, but they don't have a relationship. And so it kind of looks, just to simplify that diagram, this is one of our problems. A dispenser trying to make an electronic connection with the manufacturer and verify a product. And to them, it looks more like this because they're unaware of anything that occurred in the supply chain. Certainly manufacturer number one knows that they have sold that product to a certain wholesaler. The dispenser one knows where they purchased it from, but they don't know each other and they don't know really what happened inside that supply chain.
Hey, Bob, I got a quick question. Yep. So is the requirement to have them actually trace all the way back, or is it like a one up, one down requirement where they have to just know where it came from previously and then that responsibility to know who was the previous provider or where the product came from is then now passed on to that other party to do the same?
Yeah, and this is an area of the law where there's some interpretation and argument. And I'll say that the wholesalers today at this point in time believe it's one up and one down. The FDA has provided very clear signals that they don't believe that that's the case. They believe, and the statute actually says that each participant in the supply chain needs to have the systems and processes in place to gather the previous TIs leading back to the manufacturer. So say that then it's their problem, go back at their step and so on and so forth. I think predominantly the FDA believes, no, this is a case where we're going to knock on your door and you need to provide all those TIs going back. So that's where we get into the situation that we see here, dispenser having to go back to a manufacturer and try to verify a product.
Thanks for clarifying.
Yeah, it's you know, that, and that's, we go back and forth on this all the time, and so it creates havoc with design. So here's the issue that we have. Manufacturer is contacted by some unknown entity, and the dispenser is contacting what they hope is the manufacturer, but they don't really know. They may have gotten this information from who they purchased it from. In the case where that wholesaler or secondary wholesaler might have been a nefarious character, they may have given them a website address of, you know, that they're operating. So the dispenser now making this electronic connection needs to find out, is this actually the manufacturer that I've connected to? The manufacturer actually has two questions. One is, are they a legitimate company in the supply chain? In other words, do they have the proper licenses? Is this a legitimate dispenser? Manufacturer doesn't care if they're a dispenser or a wholesaler, just that they're legitimate in the supply chain. And then secondarily, have they legitimately owned the product in the past? So what we don't want is a rogue wholesaler just spitting out identifiers to the manufacturer to determine what somebody else might own, and then they would counterfeit that product. So we've had in the past where criminals have operated as wholesalers only to gather the information that's on the bottles, and then they return those bottles, and then they counterfeit them and move them forward. And so you have got two bottles with the same ID on them. Whoever gets verified first is usually, you know, thought of as the, well, the second one would throw up some questions, but so there's a lot of this, not a lot of this, but this is the situation that they're trying to correct. So we've started to look into, in our studies, we've started to look into the area of verifiable credentials. So a way of both distributed identity and verifiable credentials as a way of possibly solving for this. So we think we've solved the one issue of how does a dispenser actually find a manufacturer, and that's come out in a number of ways through organizations, and also the GS1 standards body has produced a standard around this of finding the endpoint of the manufacturer through a resolver service. So we can now assume that a dispenser or a wholesaler can electronically connect to a manufacturer. They still have to go through this process of, you know, have I actually connected to the manufacturer that I think I'm connecting to and all of that. So we're looking at the use of decentralized identity and then verifiable credentials in order to prove at both ends that they are who they are and that they should have access to the information that they're requesting. So that kind of brings up to where we were in our last call, that this is what we're exploring. We're trying to explore how verifiable credentials work. How do we extract a particular claim from a credential? Who might be issuing these credentials? The ultimate would be if the state boards of pharmacy, the FDA, the DEA would issue credentials to those that they license. That would be the ultimate. I'm not sure if we'll get there in the next decade, let's say. A lot of this work is being done. There are some boards of pharmacy, Illinois, I believe, and possibly California, that are looking into credentials. British Columbia in Canada, which doesn't help us in the US, but British Columbia and Ontario are starting to use verifiable credentials. As a matter of fact, I just did this morning. I went in there and now I have a credential on my phone that says British Columbia has verified my email address. So now I have a credential on my phone that I can provide to anybody that wants to know whether that's my email address. Kind of interesting what's happening in this area.
So these are consortiums that are basically nonprofits, or how are they, is the government backing them?
Yeah, this is actually the British Columbia is using, they have a thing called org book, but they are using the, oh boy, is it Vaughn? I'm trying to think what technology they're using, but this is actually the government of British Columbia that's providing this email verification service.
Okay.
Interesting. I think what they're trying to do is, they've already issued credentials to companies that work in British Columbia, and now I think they're maybe trying to connect in from maybe not a patient access, but a citizen access to information on British Columbia's site. I think they're trying to experiment with that a bit. So in our studies, what we found is, again, as I went through the DSCSA law and the lumps and bumps and problems with it, is that from a blockchain perspective, we've tried putting information on the blockchain and that hasn't worked. It may work at some point in the future. We have had models where we hold a hash of the TI to prove its validity at a future date, and that's a nominal benefit that we've seen. We've also looked at, there are provisions in the law that state that you actually have to do a certain thing under certain circumstances. So for example, if you see suspect product or illegitimate product, those are two definitions in the law, you have to quarantine the product. And then you have to do a bunch of other steps with your trading partners and with the FDA. We've already seen a $150 million fine for one of the large wholesalers where the FDA believed they did not take those steps. And so we've looked at, maybe it would be interesting is then when you actually do those steps that you have some sort of credential around that and register that possibly up on a blockchain. So we've looked at those kind of things so that if you are called up at a later point to say, did you quarantine that? Maybe there's some, maybe that provides a better avenue of proof to avoid those kind of fines. And then lastly, as I just showed you.
Hi, Google. I have a question, Bob.
Sure.
Google from IBM. Can you expand on what you mean by holding PI on blockchain does not work? Or that was your statement, right?
Yeah. So what we initially thought was in our very first study, which was 2.5 years ago, when we didn't know what blockchain was, we were trying to figure out whether the C in blockchain was capitalized or not. That's where we were. We were looking at it to say if we treat blockchain like a big database and we take all the transaction information and throw it up on a blockchain, is that how it should be used? And we found a few issues with that. Number one, blockchains typically are not useful with throwing a lot of information at it, especially not at the speed that this information that gets created. Secondarily, we had issues with creating confidentiality around some of this information. As we ran our models that you saw, the simulation models, we would take the data out of them, and we had a entity in our study that has AI background, and I would hand the data off to them and say, can you tell anything about these enterprises based on the data that you see? And they would come back and say, I could start to see the patterns of shipments, of receipts. I understand where their trucks are going. So, that started to become business intelligence that you got out of the data. So we came to the conclusion that for right now, until we get to privacy enabling blockchain interactions, that blockchain is probably not the place to put all the data. So our second thing was, okay, so what can we use blockchain for?
Do you know which platform you used? Do you remember?
Which platforms?
Was it Ethereum? Was it Fabric?
I think we weren't actually using a platform. We were simulating a platform. And so I think that that group was probably keying more in on Ethereum, which, might be problematic.
Right. So, I mean, the technology has come a long way in 2 years. And it has addressed a lot of what you mentioned. The AI bit piece is still, I think, something of a concern. But of the three, the too much data, the slow, and confidentiality, Fabric, for example, has addressed a lot of that.
That's great to hear.
So maybe that's something we can go more in depth on. But I don't know, Mukul, if you had anything to add to that, that you're from IBM.
A minor addition is, I kind of, at least I'm more than halfway through reading through the DSCSA, the GS1 implementation guide for DSCSA, right? And there they define from GS1 perspective, what is the information that should comprise TI, what is the information that comprise TS, and how GS1 events and that can be used, or can existing EPCIS events can be modified a little bit or appended to incorporate this, right, to kind of satisfy this. So that's where my question was more coming from, saying blockchain, I think Fabric wise it may have capabilities, definitely I think it has come a long way absolutely. At the same time, using some of those GS1 standards and imposing them on and building a solution on top of Fabric. So Fabric in conjunction with that, I hopefully can provide, what you are asking for. And that was the spirit of my question, saying, I just want to know if there's more or was there something I was missing big time, but that was my line of thinking.
Yeah, I think the industry is initially aligned around EPCIS. It is one of the five technologies that the FDA has recognized, at least in one of their guidances. What we've done is we've extracted from the EPCIS the essentials of TI, TS, and I'll just show you here. We've created essentially a JSON structure rather than an XML structure around that. And so we've been playing around that, what that means from a perspective of creating a more dense or, you know, less verbose data structure, and also what would need to be signed and how can we use this structure throughout the supply chain. We've got some interesting things at both ends of the supply chain. At the beginning, we've got homogeneous shipments. You know, it's all one product on in a pallet. You know, thousands of the same product. So, you know, the data structure could be drastically made smaller. Mm-hmm. At the other end of the supply chain, we've got a tote with mixed manufacturers' products that have taken different trips through the supply chain, and so it's a different, you know, different case. So we've played around with some of this business, and this has to do with the how we would organize this information in order to achieve providing, especially at the end of the supply chain, transaction statements, which is a legal constraint that says I complied with DSCSA, and that's the piece that the FDA wants, because that's what they'll take you into court for. If you provide this information and you actually didn't, they consider that to be a legal contract, if you will.
Can I ask you, Bob, how does the DSCSA correspond to the new FDA Food Safety Modernization Act? Do they cross over at all? Because I know they're having a hearing on how blockchain might be used and with the FDA and meeting this new rule late next month in DC.
Mm-hmm.
Is there overlap between the two, or is it completely separate and we're going to have to follow food safety modernization and then separately do DSA and make sure we're compliant across the board?
Yeah, I would say primarily they're separate, but there probably is some bleed over. I know the foods. So the FDA, you know, they're all in one, essentially one, place down in Maryland, and I think they talk together.
Yeah.
You see a lot of this, the language bleed over between the drug side, the medical device side, the food side, the tobacco side, and all that. So you start to see some interaction between them, but when you get down to the nitty gritty, not. And that's a little frightening, I guess.
Well, it's government, but thank you.
Thanks, Will.
So, one of the things that we're a little bit stuck on here is, again, I said we were trying to look into how verifiable credentials might help with this almost ad hoc relationship building. If you look at the supply chains, there's about 3,500 manufacturers. There's three major wholesalers, and then about 2,400 others, and then there's 64 to 70,000 dispensers in the country. And so, you know, on a day-to-day, hour-by-hour basis, there may be this relationship establishment on the fly. So that's why we're looking at verifiable credentials. But one of the things that we are kind of struggling with a little bit is, whenever you look at verifiable credentials and some of the flows for how they work, you know, they always show the holder provides the verifier with the credential, but no one actually shows. Actually, there was one area that I saw, and I think UPort had it, where the verifier would say, "These are the credentials I need, or these are the claims I need in order for you to access this information." So that's an area that we're kind of stuck on a little bit. And I'll just show you what you port. And it's really the thing I'm talking about is, this disclosure request here and how to actually go about, sorry about that. How to do that so that we can actually pilot this.
So you're saying to actually verify a request.
Well, not only to verify,
authorized.
But let's say that I'm trying to connect to you. In a lot of the diagrams, it just shows me providing you with credentials. But I think the first thing that actually happens is I connect to you and you say, oh, if you want that information, this is what you need to give me. And then I present you the credentials. And which I think UPort is starting to get into here with this disclosure request, which is saying, if you want this information, you need to provide me something to the equivalent of this or this exact thing. And that's an area that we're trying to explore a little bit. So for example, just to give the old driver's license example, if I'm going to prove that I'm over 18, I could give you my driver's license or part of that, or I could give you maybe even part of my passport. That also could prove that I'm over 18. But what is the, technically, how do I request that you provide me with something in a way that you can interpret it, your systems can interpret it, and then they can look and see whether they've got the right claims or credentials and then provide that. So that was a quick buzzsaw run through of what we're doing. I'm happy to talk either if you want to have a discussion about what's going on with the law or with the supply chain, where they're at, or with some of what we're exploring.
I don't want to hijack it. I want to give anybody else an opportunity on the call here to ask any questions or provide any input or feedback based on what we talked about. So feel free to go ahead and interject.
Sure, I've got a question for you, Bob. This is Alan Gelly from Auburn University RFID Lab, by the way. You mentioned at the beginning of the presentation that most of the product out there in the pharmaceutical supply chain right now is serialized. What way is that product serialized?
It's serialized with a GS1 data matrix, which is a two-dimensional barcode. It looks like a little bit like a QR code, but without the little corner squares.
Gotcha. And that all traces back to the underlying SG10, correct?
It does. Yeah, in there is the G10, a serial number, lot number, and expiration date.
Okay, gotcha. I know we spent a little bit of time talking about EPCIS, and what our team is working on right now is a proof of concept. It's primarily retail apparel CPG, but we're building off of Fabric. We're using a more modern EPCIS adaptation, that JSON format that it sounds like your team's working on also. We're dealing with millions and millions of eaches of individual products in a couple of our partner supply chains. And, the only real throughput concerns we've had are with the, temporary applications that our team has actually put together. But I wanted to bring that back up just to what I'm looking for here, to agree with everyone else that, there's definitely more scalability than there was before. And we're using a lot of the same components that it sounds like you are in a blockchain environment. And we're having a decent amount of success right now.
Oh, that's interesting. Maybe I can make it have a few of you folks be on one of my calls.
Sure. If you want to provide information too on that, that'd be great.
Okay.
We can join and participate. And, you're always welcome here too. We also are looking for projects as a team to collaborate on to solve these types of issues.
Good.
Yeah, we'd love to get more information in a presentation on that. And it's a really great example of how to take one physical good in the supply chain and apply it to another type of physical good, which I think is really important here too. We have a lot of conversations around food versus pharma versus everything else. It's important to have that meta view of supply chain and then drill downwards into different taxonomies like retail goods and food, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know in the retail, so I worked on the RFID standards when I was with GS1. The retail is using more RFID, which is, wonderful. We were hoping this would go the same way, but at the time, I think they keyed in on, at the time, I think they still thought that they could defeat the law, make sure that the law didn't actually happen. And they saw RFID as more expensive. But I think as they're starting to see the issues here with aggregating and disaggregating and all of that, maybe some people are regretting that decision, maybe.
And to your point, you know, retail apparel specifically has definitely adopted RFID more than others. But one of the things that we have to zoom out and focus on a lot of times is, you know, as long as we're dealing with an SG tin in some level, that could be a data matrix, that could be QR code, it could be RFID tag, doesn't matter. That's really what's important. And so, you know, there's 14 billion RFID tags out there in the retail apparel world right now. And that adoption rate, specifically within food and pharma, is climbing really, really fast. So the technology definitely has gotten more mature over time, and it's gotten more affordable. There was actually a story that we came across fairly recently, and I don't want to take too much time here, but it's pharma related, because there was a pair of brothers that had essentially a ring going where they would put out a price list for, you know, off the shelf supplements or vitamins or medicine, and they would have usually undocumented immigrants go into stores like CVS or Walmart, whatever it is, and shoplift those goods. Once they successfully shoplifted those goods, they would, you know, FedEx them to a, I believe it was a warehouse in Jersey, where they would then strip all the product, repalletize it, and then this ring would sell it back to, you know, wholesalers and to companies like CVS or Walmart, the ones that they stole the product from in the first place. And so that was growing in scale pretty rapidly, and it was starting to confuse a lot of the retailers, because not only were they losing product, but they, on a couple of instances, received the product that had been stolen from their shelves after they repurchased it. So Prevagen was actually able to start embedding RFID tags into the bottles of all their products. And so they were able to use that as kind of ink in the water to trace all those goods. And it got to the point where when the FBI finally went to make a bust at one of those warehouse facilities in Jersey, they borrowed a couple RFID readers and went in there so they could actually pick up those identifiers embedded in the tags themselves. And they were able to unravel the whole fiasco with that data embedded in the SG tin. So
interesting.
That, kind of an extreme example, but one that's definitely relevant.
Yeah, I know SysTech has a technology where they kind of do a fingerprint of the barcode, because there's some, you know, different changes between the barcodes as they're printed. And they can do the same kind of thing where at the end they could say whether that's the barcode or not. So if somebody is counterfeiting, for example, and they just copy the barcode, it's not going to be actually the same copy as the one that they read it off of.
Has that come up a lot for you guys, Bob, in terms of looking at the economy and the economics behind this, of using RFID versus using IoT or anything like that, when you might be dealing with, you know, cold foods, obviously, or refrigerated items? Are you guys getting into the logistics of what other technologies you need to bring into bear besides blockchain to really enable it, and if it's practical?
Well, I would say with the pharmaceutical industry, we looked into RFID way back in 2003. So they actually made a decision back then. Had they known what they know now, maybe the smart move would have been a different decision. But also you have the case of, you know, apparel is a great product for RFID. I mean, you know, there's not a lot of metal in it. There's not a lot of liquids in it. when you get into pharmaceuticals and liquids, and, you know, back in 2003, we had some issues with readability.
Any other questions? Anybody have any input that they want to add?
I have a question. So in speaking about the law and legislation.
Oh, looks like you put yourself on mute, Brent, or somebody did.
Okay. Am I back? Okay.
Yeah, you're back.
Yeah, you're okay. Good.
Okay, good. So my question is about the law and legislation. I would like to start taking some leadership in Michigan, because my group is disrupting the precious metal industry. And I'm working right now with WeWork. And we're trying to bring leadership to Lansing about the distributed ledger in supply chains. And so obviously the pharmaceutical industry has really blazed the trail. Is there anything that I can obtain so that I can have a point of reference when I'm basically lobbying my government?
As far as the viability of blockchain, is that what you're after, or showing like another reference point?
Yes. Just some point of reference would be, I think, advantageous.
Yeah, actually, I think there's a couple things you can reference. I mean, certainly you could reference, a couple of our white papers that we've published. You could also reference the FDA's.
Where can I find those?
Oh, on my website.
Okay.
Now, you're going to read them and go, "Ugh, this is bad," because they were from 2018 when we were getting ready to write another white paper around what we've seen now. But at that point, that's where it was. The other area that would probably be interesting would be the FDA's website. If you just go into their website and type in DSESA pilots. I'm actually administering pilots for the FDA right now, and they're running about, I think there's 20 pilots, and I would say about maybe half of them have something to do with blockchain. So that, at least that it's at that level would give you somewhat of a validation point.
Thank you.
Yeah. And then I think some of those pilots, those teams would certainly be able to talk to you about what they're doing. There's the MediLedger folks, they're neck deep in this. Another company called RX Transparent, I think they have a blockchain backing to their solution.
Can I send you an email?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, thanks.
No problem. Yeah, I think there's I don't know how the legislature goes in Michigan. A lot of these states have what they call sunshine laws, where you can't really talk to them unless it's in a public meeting. And it's very difficult, because I spent about 7 years of going to monthly meetings or quarterly meetings at California, just over time to try to educate them in these kind of things. At that time, it was RFID and track and trace and that type of thing.
Well, lucky for me, a lot of my representatives like to come to Birmingham and Bloomfield Hills. So it's easy for me to go into these forums or into these public forums.
Good.
Great. Anybody else?
And just a thing that I brought up before, take a look at British Columbia's website. They're trying their hardest to use blockchain and verifiable contracts and DIDs. So that might be a point. I actually had the guy from British Columbia speak on one of my calls. So you could probably get a hold of them.
Actually, that'd be really interesting. Maybe I'll just reach out to you directly, Bob, to see if he'd be interested in joining this call.
Yeah.
We would love that perspective. It's very different what we're seeing in Canada from the U.S. and in Europe, so it's really valuable to get that perspective.
Yeah, Canadians are really open to trying things out.
Great, thank you. So we have 10 minutes left, I don't know if anybody else wants to add anything, or if Bob, if you also had any questions for us, or what you're looking for and how we can help you. Really open to that for the next 10 minutes here.
Yeah, I would love to learn a little bit more about, as like I said, our initial problem was in the supply chain, they wanted confidentiality. So what that means to them was that you can trace something. In other words, you could see where something came from, because that's the law said you had to have that capability. But you can never track it. So you can never go, where did it go after I shipped it? And I'm interested in some of the, kind of, I guess, privacy preserving kind of things that may have occurred since we did our initial study,
sure.
2 years ago.
And I'm sure there's other participants here that can chime in on that. Can you actually go to that slide where you showed the supply chain overview with the lines connecting all the participants? Because mm-hmm. that'd be easier to speak to. The one that had multiple participants.
That one right there? Is that it? Or
sure. That's fine.
Do you just want this one?
No, go with the relationship ones. That's fine. So just to recap, what you were saying is that the FDA is pretty clear as that if you're D1, you need to have all information, the trace W2, W1, and M1. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Now, as another participant, let's say a third party, let's say there's like another square floating outside of that supply chain, and that's the FDA. And let's say that, they can see everything because they're authorized to see it. I mean, is that a possible solution where they can, instead of having go directly to D1, they can actually just go right to the blockchain itself and see all the information?
Well, we've attempted to present that to the industry, and the industry has vehemently rejected that. So, and the reason why is this. If the FDA finds an anomaly or they find something they don't understand, their first reaction might be starting to shut down people's licenses or fines or sending letters out, and that's damaging to companies' stock prices and all kinds of things. So the industry has been vehement about saying the only way the FDA gets information is the way they do today, which is either we have a good relationship with them and we provide that, or they subpoena us and then we provide it. So, I agree with you that the systematic way of doing this would be have FDA as being a party to all of this with certain permissions that they could exercise, but the industry won't even go near that.
Okay. All right. So that was one approach. The second thing is now with the technology that's come this far, in Fabric, there's a concept of a private data collection. So between participants, you can establish what data you want to share, and that data you want private, it's obfuscated. So they don't actually see the data itself. They just see a cryptographic hash or something like that. So you'd be able to trace, and the information you can see is only what you have access to. I think MetaLedger has something of a similar approach where they obfuscate the data, although I don't know too much detail because they don't share much detail.
But yeah, they're using
my side discussions.
I think they're using zero knowledge proofs.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm not sure how they do it, though.
Yeah, the PDC from Fabric was introduced about a year ago or so. So that was done after the fact. And the reason I say Fabric is because it's been the most flexible when it comes to enterprise. Mm-hmm. And I know Mukul is on. You probably have more in-depth knowledge on Fabric than the majority of us. But, even the transactions is much faster compared to Ethereum.
Mm. Well, I can also say, we work with a lot of private languages like, R3's Corda and Kadena and Multichain. Fabric has definitely been the most successful in the supply chain space of being proliferated and used across different industries. And it's definitely, and Hyperledger as an organization has had better relationships with groups like the FDA and Vita, et cetera.
Good.
So whenever you do
most other industries aren't really touching it. They're looking at manufacturing and alongside pharma, or they're looking at food by itself or finance. They're not really looking at supply chain more broadly like that.
Mm. Right. And you have your experience with GS1. And I know, for example, IBM Food Trust, from my personal experience, it is built on Fabric and they use GS1 to track the food supply chain. And that's what Walmart's using, companies like Albertsons, Kroger, other companies are coming on board. So where you were 2 years ago to where the technology is now has evolved enough where I would say it's probably worth going back and redoing that and seeing the landscape of what technology is out there. Mm-hmm. But that one thing you mentioned about the AI, that is interesting because as these blockchain networks start to grow with data, one would wonder whoever owns that network or runs it now, or how much information they'd have access to. And if you put machine learning on top of that, what they can find out about that.
Right.
So that's something I'm personally curious and concerned about.
And in a lot of ways, that's independent from blockchain. You know, we're seeing that there's a really, just ironically, there's a really great article this month, and I think it's a Fast Company around Google and what they're doing with AI and bringing AI together with quantum and machine learning and how much power it's giving them. But they don't talk about blockchain at all. And I think it's because in a lot of ways they feel that if they master quantum and machine learning and AI, it doesn't matter if they're working with distributed or centralized databases, they can crack any database or any protocol structure.
Wow.
Sorry to deviate, but it's an interesting conversation to have.
Yeah, it is.
Indeed. Okay.
But definitely something to get into next time.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Bob, maybe every several months or so that pass, the technology changes a lot. I'm sure you have a lot of updates. We'd definitely like to have you back to see if there's anything new that comes up in industry. And, you know, we definitely would like to also be able to provide insight on where the technology is going as well. So let's keep in touch. And thanks again. Really appreciate it. Great presentation.
Great. Thanks, I appreciate it. And I'll send you some information. Well, I'll send you out this deck, but I'll also maybe an invite to our group to talk a little bit about how technology changed. I think they'd appreciate that.
Absolutely. Send me the info. I'll put it part of the meeting notes, and I'll take this recording also. That'll all be up there for everyone. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Bob, if you could include a link to your white papers also, or the FDA study that you were talking about, along with your deck, it would be really helpful. And of course, we always welcome you to join our group here, and we'd be very happy to talk to your group.
Okay, good. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.